Okay, let's get started. The last lecture of the summer school. So I'm going to be continuing with where I left off, but just to kind of remind you where we were. The main theorem we are going to show is this tight hardness result for approximating Krillin. So even if you're almost satisfiable, you cannot satisfy more than half plus gamma things. And the way we set up was we showed a reduction from, you can do it from label cover, but for sake of exposition, I'm doing it from unique games, and it simplifies the proof a little bit. So what we are going to do is reduce from unique games, and I've written down the reduction again. So if you recall, the unique games had, it was a bipartite instance. V and W were the vertices, and between each pair, each edge in that graph, there was a bijection constraint. So when you gave a label to W, that fixed the label for V, and vice versa. And the reduction, what it's going to do is we're going to check that these two labels match according to this bijection by encoding it by checking three variable linear equations. And now the variables are going to be values of the long code. So for each W, and you have a long code encoding its label, a supposed long code, and that's what we are testing. So how did we do this? We picked a random vertex, V, and to pick three of its neighbors independently, allowing repetitions. If they, sampling with replacement. And then you pick a random spot, two random strings X and Y, and then you take a small amount of slightly noisy string mu and make the third string, which is X plus Y. And then you basically pull back these X's and Y and Z, and then you just simply check that you go to their respective long codes, and when you add up these values, it's zero. And the second part is just a folding trick, because if you just check this, I will just give you all zeros. And you will always accept. So, okay, this is all stuff we did last time. And we also proved that if the unique games had a good assignment satisfying 1 minus epsilon 0 of the constraints, you can essentially faithfully write the long codes of those that assignment. And we just calculated that that will pass this test with probability at least 1 minus 3 epsilon 0 minus epsilon. Okay, so since epsilon 0 is arbitrarily small, epsilon is the parameter of the test. That's very close to 1. So now the crux of the matter is to prove the soundness, where we want to show that if you start with an instance which is very low value for the unique games, then the verifier does not accept with probability more than half. Okay, so before we do that, were there any questions about any of this? Okay, this is kind of where we left off, and exactly where we left off was we arithmetized the probability of acceptance of the verifier. Because what is the verifier doing? It's reading these three bits. And of course, there has been a notational change from here to here. We are assuming that all the tables have range, which is not 0, 1, but 1 minus 1. And the advantage of that is that when you check the three bits, their XOR is 0, it's the same thing in the plus minus 1 notation, that checking their product is equal to 1. So that test is basically that this product is equal to 1. So 1 plus this by 2 is an indicator of whether the test accepts. And the same thing for 1 minus this by 2. So the probability of that the test accepts is simply by definition just exactly equal to this. Okay? And this is what we are going to try to simplify and try to analyze it. And we'll do it using discrete Fourier analysis. And I'll also point out why it's natural to bring in Fourier analysis into this business. Okay, but let's just slightly simplify this one more line. And what you can really do here is you can define a new table, GV of X, which is simply going to be the following. Pick a random neighbor of it, and now take its long. These are tables which don't exist in the proof, but I'm going to make them up for the analysis. Okay, so GV of X will simply be the following table. You cannot see here. Okay, so I'm now defining a new table. For all V, what I'm going to do is essentially I'm going to take a random neighbor, read its corresponding value, and average it. Okay, and the corresponding this is the thing. And this definition, the intuition come, you'll see it in a second in the analysis. But also, if all the FWs were long codes, And they are were consistent in the sense that when you map it according to the various projections, they give the same label for V, then this will also be a long code. Okay, that's an easy thing to check. So if everything was true, then this would just be the long code also, but otherwise it's just some function. And note that, you know, even if it's just some function which maps 0, 1 to the R to the bounded interval minus 1, 1, because you're averaging quantities which are either plus 1 or minus 1. Okay, so it's a function, a real valued function in a bounded range. Why did I define this? Well, the point is these W1, W2, W3 are independent choices from the neighborhood. Okay, I should also say, I keep forgetting this, this choice is from the neighborhood. Okay, only the neighborhood projects back to you. Okay. And so why did I define this? Because W1, W2, W3 are in, well, first of all, I can take the expectation with respect to W1, W2, W3 inside. And once I do that, these guys are independently chosen. So I claim that this whole expression just equals, well, first of all, the halves I can collect, and I just get a half outside. So let me do that. And now I'm going to get an expectation over, let's keep the VXY mu. But now I'm going to take the expectation over W's inside. And when I do that, expectation over W of X prime is exactly GV of X, because X prime was exactly the pullback of X. Okay, so if these pi W to V's bother you, just think of them as identities. Okay, so then it's X prime equals X. There's really nothing really lost in that. It's just, you know, we have to be correct, syntactically correct, so we do. Okay, so this quantity, when I take expectation over W1, is just GV of X. Likewise, this is GV of Y, and so on. Minus, the minus is for this term, X, GVY, GVZ bar. Okay? That's just based on this definition. Okay, at least the nice thing now is that in some sense, it's looking like a much simpler expression. Right? So there were lots of functions here, now it's just one function. Okay, in some sense, what you're really doing is you're taking a node on the right, taking the average of the long codes of its neighbors. And that's kind of an important function which we are calling to be GV. Okay, so is this clear? I mean, it's just, at least syntactically, should be clear. Okay. And now comes the part we want to analyze, what if we want to understand, make some sense out of this. Okay. So in particular, let's what was Z? So let's just stare at this term for a second. So the next part is really going to be this crux of the matter, where we talk about Fourier analysis and express, sort of simplify this expression. Okay, and this expression will be similar. It's just the same thing. Okay, let's see how to simplify this. When you look at this, what was Z? Z was X XOR Y XOR mu, the small amount of noise. Let's forget this noise for a second. Okay, so then we really just, this expression is just GVX, GVY, GVX, XOR Y. Okay, suppose this expectation over all XY was 1. So the largest it can be is 1, because it's a 1 minus 1, its values are bounded. If this was 1, what does that mean? That means for every XY, GV of X plus Y is the product of GVX, GVY. Okay, and that's just the linear, means that it's a linear function. We just did the switch to plus 1, minus 1, so addition became multiplication. So if this is 1, implies GV is a linear function. And we would like to understand, in some sense, how linear it is and make some sense out of this expression. Note that if GV was a perfect long code, that's also a linear function. Okay. Now, what are all the linear functions from 0, 1 to the R to 1 minus 1. What's a linear function? A linear function is such that Lx, L of X plus Y should be Lx times Ly. Okay, it's just a group homomorphism from 0, 1 to the R to 1 minus 1. Here the operation is multiplication. Here it is bit addition. Okay, that's just what a linear function is. So what are all the linear functions? Okay, so we know all the linear functions. So here is a fact. So the linear functions are simply dot product functions, right? So you will just take X and take its dot product with some other vector. But here we are in the plus 1, minus 1 notation, so we'll just have to exponentiate it. So this is a fact, is that the functions chi sub alpha. So this is the function you take the dot product with, defined by chi sub alpha of x equals minus 1 to the alpha dot x, or all the linear functions. Okay, they are precisely true to the R linear functions, and these are them. Okay, these are the group homomorphisms from this group to the other one. And since we would like for GV to be a long code, and in particular linear, we kind of want to understand how it correlates with linear functions. So what we are now going to do is expand this, after all these G's are coming from real valued functions on 0, 1 to the R. So that's a real vector space. So we are, and what is also known is that these functions form a basis for that vector space, and these are all things I've written down as an exercise in the notes. So the chi alphas form a basis, an orthonormal basis, and I'll say with respect to what product in a second, basis of the vector space f, which is all functions from 0, 1 to the r to real. Okay, this is a 2 to the r dimensional real vector space, right? Because to what's the standard basis for this vector space? You simply tell me the value at each bit string. Okay, you can think of this as so this of course is isomorphic to R 2 to the R, right? Because you're just telling me a value at 2 to the R places. That's a 2 to the R dimensional vector space, and there is standard basis, which is the coordinate basis. But that's not a good, interesting basis for us. We want to understand correlation with linear functions. So it's a fact that these linear functions, which also are exactly 2 to the R in number, also form a basis, and it's an orthonormal basis with respect to what is the inner product. The inner product is going to be the inner product between two functions, let's call them G and H. I'm defining an inner product. The inner product is going to be simply the average value of the dot product. Okay, this 1 over 2 to the n is just a normalization factor, 2 to the r. So this is an inner product. You can check that it satisfies all the axioms of inner product. And with respect to this inner product, I claim that these guys form an orthonormal basis. So it's a fact I'm not going to prove, but it's very easy to prove. So chi alpha, chi beta is 1 if alpha equals beta, 0 otherwise. So these 2 to the r functions are orthogonal with respect to this inner product. And I've just normalized so that inner product with itself is 1. So it's ortho. So each of them is norm 1. Okay, so this is probably a little bit fast the first time you're seeing it, but it's really, you know, Fourier analysis might sound like a complicated analytic thing, but at least in this context, it's nothing but linear algebra. We have a 2 to the r dimensional real vector space, and we are expressing functions with respect to some other basis, which is, this is called the Fourier basis, or the character basis, and that's what is going to be relevant to us. But really, you can understand everything with just linear algebra. Okay? So because of this, every function can be expressed. So since these guys form a basis, every function g on this domain, and it can take values in reals, can be expressed uniquely as g of x is going to be summation g hat alpha chi alpha of x over all alpha, where g hat of alpha is simply the inner product of g chi of alpha. Okay, again, it might look kind of complicated, but it's just linear algebra, right? Because, so we have something in this vector space. These guys form a basis. So I can write anything in my vector space as a linear combination of my basis elements. The coefficients will simply be the inner product of that function with those bases. And that's all it is. And these guys, so for some reason you could write it as g sub alpha, but you put a g hat and of alpha, and these are called the Fourier coefficients. Okay, so you're just doing Fourier analysis over this finite abelian group. The special case, these are the Fourier coefficients. Okay, but it's just some real number which is defined as the inner product between g and chi alpha. So one fact which is really very useful Is this clear? And the uniqueness also follows, right? Because there's a unique expansion of any function in terms of a base. Okay, so now here is another fact. Okay, all the things I'm writing as facts are really sort of lemmas, but they're easy to prove. So, and I've collected them all as an exercise. So here is a sort of simple fact, which is that if I take two functions, g and h, how do I take their inner product? Well, I can take their inner product, but I can also expand them out and then take this big inner product and expand out everything. Now, when I expand out, and this I'm almost giving the proof of what I'm saying, the chi alpha dot chi beta will become 0 unless alpha is beta. Right? Therefore, this guy will not have any cross terms, and this will simply be summation j hat alpha h hat alpha over all alpha. Okay, again, this is just the definition of inner product with respect to any orthogonal base. Okay, so that's another fact. Again, this is often called Parseval's identity or Plancherel's identity. It's a useful fact. And the special case of this, of course, is the fact that g dot, I can take g equals h here, and then I get that this very, a corollary of this is that if I take summation g hat alpha square, that's simply the average value, or let me just write it this to the r, summation gx square. So if my g has bounded value between 1 and minus 1, this is at most 1. So the sum of my Fourier coefficient square is at most 1 for all functions I'll be talking about. Because either I'm talking about 1 minus 1 valued functions or bounded functions. Okay, any questions about this? This is, I mean, a little bit rapid fire thing, but hopefully you just, you know, this is all, the main thing you need to really remember is this Fourier expansion and this Parseval. Okay, so I'll leave that on that board. Okay, so now with all this preparation, what we are going to do, is there a trick for this? Okay, so where is our expression? So that's our expression which I want to simplify now. Okay, so let's go back to that, and the natural thing what we are going to write is we're going to take that GV and write it in terms of this Fourier expansion, just kind of see what happens. Okay, and that's the lemma I'm going to prove next. I'll actually tell you what happens, so we'll have a target of what we're trying to prove. So, okay. Okay, here is the all-crucial lemma, which kind of takes that and simplifies that to something kind of compact in terms of Fourier coefficients. So for the way we pick things, I'll omit the subscript v there, because it's going to be true for all functions g. So the way we pick x, y, and z, which is that we pick x and y uniformly, and z as x plus y plus mu, so I can also parameterize this by mu. So I'll claim that this gx, gy, g of x plus y plus mu. So this, why do I care about this? Because this is exactly what I got there. So now I want to simplify this. This has the following expression. Where this is simply going to be the size of the support of alpha, which is the number of I such that alpha I is not equal to 1. Okay, so I'm claiming this. We'll prove it in a second. Okay, is the statement clear? So it is some sort of scary looking expression. We'll simplify from this something, but simply says it's roughly the sum of cubes of the Fourier coefficients. Alpha, yeah. No, all, yeah, all characters. Okay. Right. See, there are 2 to the r Fourier coefficients. I'm basically saying it's the sum of cubes of these Fourier coefficients.
Yes. And you are defining the absolute value of alpha by...
Yeah, absolute value of alpha is simply the number of ones in it. Yeah. So the way to think about this is that if you kind of epsilon was 0, this kind of goes away. It's just sum of cubes. Now, this epsilon was a small amount of noise. And you already see that what effect the noise has is that it is attenuating all... These alpha is like frequencies and so on. Anything with size of alpha large is going to vanish because this you're exponentiating with respect to alpha. So these will go away, and that's actually precisely how that becomes crucial. This is kind of what I said earlier. The test we defined, any linear function would have passed it, but we added a small amount of noise, and it says that linear functions with large support are going to get killed at this exponential rate. So it manifests itself in this expression. Okay? It's an exact equation. Yeah. Say yeah. In that sense, it's going to be easy. Once you know it's the exact equation, you know, you will just proceed and it will follow. Right? So if you have inequalities, this can be tricky to prove. So. And this is just pretty standard proof. But any other questions before I do the proof? Okay, so the proof is pretty much we are going to follow our recipe. This, it holds in generality, and I have Fourier coefficients here, so I'm just going to expand this G in these Fourier bases. Okay, so let's just do that. So this is going to be some giant expression. So what I'm going to do is that this G of X, I'm going to write as summation G hat alpha chi alpha X. Okay, nothing interesting there. Well, I'll do the same for this. Of course, I'll use a different index just to avoid confusion. Times G hat C. Should have just called it gamma, but gamma was taken. So okay, so this is Z. Okay, nothing has happened so far, and so now we can just expand it out. Just nothing very interesting. So we'll just say expectation x, y, mu, summation alpha, beta, c, g hat alpha, g hat beta, g hat c. Now you're just going to write all the other terms. So chi alpha, x, chi beta, sorry, this should be y. Y. And this one is going to be chi c, x, xr, y, xr, mu. Okay? So again, nothing. I've just expanded it out. All products alpha, beta, c, this happens. Okay, so now comes one more step. Again, every step is completely the obvious thing to do. So now I'll sum up over this. These guys, the expectation is only over x, y, mu. Okay, these guys are now fixed. So I'll just bring that out. G hat alpha, g hat beta, g hat c. And now I'll take the expectation inside. I'm also using here that expectation is linear. So I'm using linearity of expectation. I'll take the expectations inside. So now I get expectation of y, x, y, mu. And now I'll write chi alpha x, chi beta y. And now this is a linear function. Right? So chi c of x plus y plus mu is just a product. Because this is a homomorphism. So we'll just do that. Okay. So far, so good. Okay, and now we're almost done. So let's see, where should I continue? Okay, I'll erase this fact. Really, the only thing you need is the Fourier expansion in Parseval. Okay, very good. And now we are almost done. G hat alpha, G hat beta, G hat c. And now what you can do is that, I'll simplify this a little bit here, x, y and mu are independent. So the expectation of the product, I can just take the x part, the y part and the mu part separately. So I just get expectation over x, chi alpha x, chi, what was it, c, x. Same thing for expectation over y, chi beta y, chi c y. And the last guy is expectation over mu, chi c. Okay? This is the independence of x, y, mu. And now, if you look at this, this is just inner product of chi alpha, chi c. That was our definition of the inner product. And this is the inner product of chi beta, chi c. So these guys are zero unless alpha equals c and beta equals c. And therefore, and now you are seeing the cube already. So you had all these product terms, but now only the diagonal terms sort of survive. So now I can just get this g alpha cube. And when alpha equals beta equals c, this is 1 and this is 1. So the only thing I have is the expectation over mu of that thing, which I'll just expand now, minus 1, c is equal to alpha. So it just becomes minus 1 to the alpha dot mu. Okay? One more step. Now mu is from a product distribution. Each coordinate was sampled independently. Right? So this alpha dot mu is of course summation alpha I mu I. But since the mu i's are independent of each other, I can just write it as the expectation of the product is the product of expectation. So product over I, the expectation of minus 1 to the alpha I mu I. Because mu comes from a product distribution. And now, of course, when alpha I is 0, it doesn't matter. You're taking expectation of 1. So it just remains 1. But when alpha is minus, when alpha is 0, you're just taking expectation of 1. When alpha I is 1, you're taking expectation of mu I, minus 1 to the mu I. And what was mu I? It was 0 with probability 1 minus epsilon, 1 with probability 1 epsilon. So if you take minus 1 to the mu I, that was 1 with probability 1 minus epsilon and minus 1 with probability epsilon. So the expectation of this guy is just 1 minus epsilon times 1 minus epsilon times 1, which is 1 minus 2 epsilon. And that's, and you get a 1 minus 2 epsilon factor for each alpha I which equals 1, and hence that term. Okay, and that's it. Okay, one has to give at least one full proof. This was my one full proof. Okay. So. Any questions about this? Okay, it's fairly quick calculation. And of course, that only simplifies the first term, but you just follow the same recipe. In the second term, you will get exactly the same thing, except you will get a minus sign. Minus 1 to the alpha. So similarly, let me just write that down. Actually, let me write it here. Okay, let me move this up. So this term now, this whole term now simplifies. So let me continue this. I'll remove this intuition and continue this calculation. Okay, I forgot a half here. It should be a half. Okay, so the first term, what did we get? It was dv. Now I'll put the v back. That's the first term. Now there will also be a second term, which is going to be, I won't do the calculation, but it's identical. You'll just get an extra minus 1 factor. Because you're flipping everything, you'll get pick up a minus 1 factor. Okay. I mean, the expression is exactly the same. You just, because of the flipping, you get this extra thing. And it's the same thing. So what this basically says is that all the alphas, where the support of alpha is even, go away. They go away. Because if support of alpha is even, then this guy is also a 1, so he subtracted out. Okay. So this is actually equal to, so let me continue here, half plus half expectation. It should be a 1/4 somewhere. Actually, this was a 1/4. Because it was half times half, and here you get a half. Okay, so that's the exact expression. So far, no inequality is nothing. This is what the test does. Okay, and you might wonder why, you know, we did this z bar thing here to avoid the all zero function, and that kind of manifests itself here also. If you didn't kind of do this, you will just get this term. And now it could be the case that gv is sort of the identically one function. You put zeros everywhere, in which case you will have g, the all zero string will have all the mass one and the rest will be zero. So you will just get the whole expression to be one. That won't be good. So somehow because of this trick, all the even guys go away, in particular the empty thing goes away. So you cannot just return the constant function. Okay, it essentially forces your function to be balanced. And so on. If that comment wasn't clear, don't worry about it. We just get this fact that it's odd. And really the only feature we will use about odd is that zero is not an odd number in the next lemma we're going to use. Okay, so it's all this. So we want to sort of avoid this pesky alpha equals zero thing, but that's gone away now because this is odd. Okay, very good. Let's see where to continue. Okay. So this quantity, this is what I called theta v in the node. So we'll just give it some name. So it's basically just half plus half expectation v theta v. So just some terminology. Okay. And now comes, now what we are going to, as I said, the way we are going to prove this soundness lemma is that we'll assume, suppose this expression is more than half plus gamma, and we will try to find an assignment to the unique games instance which satisfies it with probability more than delta. Okay, and that will give us the relation between these gamma, alpha, gamma, delta, epsilon, and so on. But that's, we sort of do it in contrapositive. So let's just do that. So I'll erase this. We are still proving the soundness lemma. That's the, once we do that, we are done for this thing. Right? So suppose this was more than half plus gamma. Okay, then since we have an exact expression, that means that the expectation of theta v is more than 2 gamma. Okay, so which implies that at least gamma fraction of v's have theta v at least gamma. This is just a standard averaging argument. Since none of the theta v's is more than 1, if their average is more than say 2 gamma, decent, at least gamma of them must be at least gamma. That's just an averaging thing. So let's call these guys good. Such V is a good V. So why we call it a good V is that for these vertices V, we will be able to give a labeling that will satisfy a decent fraction of the constraints incident on it, because we have some information about these. Okay, like on these guys, in some sense, the test is doing better than what it should. So I somehow from that I will be able to say that it the tables look like some long codes and get some good labeling. Okay, that's what we'll do. And now here comes the crucial part. So how are we going to do this? So somehow whenever V is good, I want to give it some assignment. I want to give it some value from the domain 1 to R. And the question is how to do this. And the key thing for this, which is really which I mentioned as an exercise, but it's just calculation from that. So the claim is the following. So if V is good, there exists an alpha, which is not the all zero string, so it has at least one guy. And it's not too large, such that Fourier coefficient is sizable. Right, again, when is V good? It's good if this sum of cubes 1 minus 2 epsilon to the alpha is at least gamma. I want to say if it's at least gamma, and this is just arithmetic, if it's at least gamma, at least one of these low weight guys must be decently big. Okay, let's not do the calculation, but why does that follow? I mean, is simply because, first of all, we get alpha is at least 1 because only odd guys participate here. So you don't have alpha 0 lurking. And now anytime alpha is very, very big, right, it's, if it's more than say 1 over exactly that quantity written there, this inner expression will be at most like gamma over 2 or something. And the sum of all these guys is very small. I mean, the sum of all the Fourier coefficients square is very small. So there must be, because of this, you can forget about things which lie out, you know, alpha too big, you can forget. And therefore, there must be something in the lower weight, which is at least this value. Just because your overall thing is at least come. Okay, this is just arithmetic. You just stare at this expression, use Parseval's identity, that the sum of squares is at most 1, and that's it. It works. Okay. Again, what this is really saying is that if you're a good vertex, then your kind of long code, which you, your function you wrote, it cannot be too crazy in the sense that it has some decent correlation with some linear function which doesn't have large support. So it's almost some sort of projection. Projection would mean that you would like to make alpha equals exactly 1. You don't quite get that. But the key point is that this is might look large, but it's not that large. In particular, it's independent of R. Like in general, alpha is something, remember alpha is in 0, 1 to the R. So this could be as big as R, but it doesn't care about R at all. It's just some bound which is only depends on these epsilon and gamma. In that sense, there is a very strong structural limitation. Okay, so that's I'll leave that. And now it's now for the last part, where how do we use this? Pick a labeling. So now the last part is labeling for UGV. Okay, so UG instance had two kinds of vertices, V and W. So let's start with V. So for V in the right hand side, capital V, well, if V is not good, you don't know much about it, your bets are off, just set L of V to be arbitrary. Say 1. Okay, remember that you're supposed to give a labeling from V union W to 1 through R. Okay, this is the domain of the unique game CFP. I mean, I don't know anything about it, so I give up, I just give it. If V is good, what I will do is that if it's good by virtue of this lemma, you know that there is some low weight alpha which has sizable Fourier coefficient. Okay, there may be many of them, but you don't really care. You pick an arbitrary one. Let alpha not equal 0 be such that G hat V alpha is at least gamma by 2. Okay, and what you will really do is that pick L of V equals any element in its support. And alpha, remember, is not 0, so this is sensible. So it will have something in the support, and its support won't be too big also, but you just pick one of them arbitrarily. You can pick one of them randomly too, but just pick arbitrarily. So this finishes one side of the equation. Now we need to do the other side. Okay, is this clear? Again, what is the structure of this argument? We designed this test. We want to prove that the test accepts with low probability. So now what you're saying, well, if the test did not accept with low probability, it accepted with probability more than half plus gamma, then in the contrapositive, I'll prove that the unique games instance has a good labeling. And I'll do it. I'll show you the labeling, and this is the labeling of one side. Okay, next I'll define the labeling for the W side, and then we'll try to analyze how many constraints this labeling satisfies. Okay, that's the rest of the argument. Okay, now for W in so now what I'll do is the following. I'm just going to define a set. Basically what I'll do is I'll take all betas in 0, 1 to the r. And I'll take the union of its support. So it's going to be a very similar decoding to this side. What we did was we looked at Fourier coefficients of the GV table which have sizable mass. Now for the W side, you actually were given these supposed long codes FW. So I'll use them. Okay, so I'll take this, and the condition is simply going to be that F hat beta is sizable and it's not too big. The same size as that. Okay, the exact bounds here doesn't, not so important. But it's really the same thing. Instead of GV table, I'll do it with FW. And I'll take each such beta, and I'll take all its support, and I'll take the union. This gives me a big set. If it doesn't exist, very good question. Let's define this. It could be empty. Right? So now the labeling of W is going to be arbitrary element if it's empty, otherwise pick a random element from it. So this LW is really in some sense what's called the list decoding of labels for this vertex or variable W. It's a list of labels. You don't quite zero in on one label, you get a list of labels. And you're going to pick a random element. Okay, this set could be empty, so in that case you give up. You just give some arbitrary. So the analysis will prove that it will be non-empty enough. Okay, so here is a simple exercise. Again, it follows from definition and this, that this set, it won't be too large. So of course, it's easy for me to do a list decoding. I could say LW equals 1 to R. Okay, then certainly you have to give a label from that. That's not very useful. The point in this is that this is not going to be too large. In particular, it's going to be at most order 1 over epsilon, 1 over gamma, 1 over epsilon gamma square times log 1 over gamma. Okay, so I'll forget the being exact with constant. So roughly some constant which only depends on epsilon and gamma. The proof of this is really one line, which is that, well, I'm taking union of certain things whose support is not too big. So the only thing is that's really the 1 over epsilon log 1 over gamma factor. The question is how many such things can I take? Well, each one of them has a sizable Fourier coefficient, and the sum of squares of the Fourier coefficients is 1. So there's not too many. That's why this is small. Yeah, I should exercise this. Yeah, this exercise or lemma or fact, whatever, is that this is utmost. This is for all W. So the list is never too big. Okay? But now I've given them. That finishes the labeling. So now the only part left is, I have to say that because of my assumption, so now I have to do the analysis and say how good is this label. But is this so far clear? Okay, so now let's analyze this. The analysis is based on one quick lemma, which we will prove, and that will kind of connect up everything together. So, in sort of these projections and the aspects of the unique games will come back. So here is the lemma. So in writing the lemma, so the point is we want to analyze how good this labeling is, what fraction of constraints it satisfies. Now, if V is not good, there's nothing we know about it. So let's just not worry about it. The point is a decent fraction of V's are good. And remember, this was a regular instance I assumed in the beginning. So if I get good value on the good V's, I'm fine. Okay, so I'll only focus on good V's. So suppose V is good. Then for at least gamma over 4 fraction of neighbors of V. What should be right? What do we want to say here, right? So for V we are given the label L of V. And for its neighbors, we are giving a random element from LW. So if we want to have any chance of success, it better be the case that something in LW projects to L of V. Okay? So I'll write that. So L of V belongs to the projection of this label set, which is defined to be simply the projection of individual elements. So I want to prove this. Okay, but before we prove this, that you know, let's see why this is good for us. Suppose we prove this, then what is the probability? Suppose we prove this, then what's the probability that? So okay, so we could give these gamma over fraction names. I didn't do it in the notes, but let's give it friendly to V, some catchy name like that. So these guys are friendly to V. Now the point is, if for let W be friendly to V, in the sense that this happens. Now what's the probability that pi, the label you give, matches? Well, it's exactly, in fact, 1 over the size of L. Because what do you know? You know that L of V is sort of the inverse image. The label which is associated with L of V, remember, it's a unique constraint. That is, once I tell you it's L of V for V, I know the label for W. And that's just the pi inverse of L of V. And we know that pi inverse L of V belongs to my set LW. Okay, that's why it was friendly to V. And with probability 1 in LW, I'll pick that. And then my constraint will be satisfied. So this is sort of a randomized assignment. Okay. I mean, think of this sort of naive random algorithm, right? We picked a random element from 1 to R. That wasn't too smart. But now we kind of zeroed in on a slightly more, much smaller, clever set, and we just pick it random from that. And as long as I have consistency within the set, I'm going to hit it with good probability. Okay, and this is a decent size set, right? So this is at least omega gamma cube epsilon or something. It's a constant fraction. Because LW is not too big. Is that clear? Should I repeat that? Okay. So maybe a picture will help. So you have V and you're given it L of V. Right? So you're given it some value. Let's say it's A. And here for this vertex W, you have a small bag. Right, or a small bag of values. And you know that one of these values projects to this guy. That's what friendliness means. And I'm picking a random one in this, so I'll hit it with good probability. And that's what this is. Okay, so that's good. So this only works when V is good and W is friendly for V. But both of these guys happen with good probability. So if I do this, in expectation, my expected fraction of pi WV satisfied, what's the expected fraction of unique game constraints which are satisfied? I just need to lower bound this. Right? When V is good and W is friendly for V, I'm good. But with probability, at least gamma, V is good. And when V is good, at least gamma over 4 of its neighbors are friendly to V. So I multiply that by gamma over 4. And when both these things happen, my success probability for satisfying this constraint is omega. I'm hiding constant factors, it's something like that. Okay, but it's a small constant factor. So the whole thing is something like epsilon times gamma to the 5. So this is the probability with which I satisfy any single constraint. So the expected fraction of constraints is just this. By just linear to that. So I have given you a randomized way to assign things to the unique game instance, which satisfies an expected so many fraction of constraints. In particular, there must exist a labeling with at least or assignment with this value. And that shows that this quantity, on the other hand, we know that this better be at most delta, because we assumed that our instance was at most delta satisfied. And therefore, gamma should be at most what I promised. Gamma is at most order of delta by epsilon to the 1/5. Okay, and that was the claim. So if delta is tiny compared to epsilon, you're done. Okay, so the crux of the matter is this friendliness lemma. Okay, and it's not hard. It's just, it's always nice to finish the broader proof and leave it to one lemma, which we will prove now. But any questions about this? Right, you are basically decoding an assignment for unique games from these tables, FB, FW, that's all I've shown. It's just a good old reduction, it's just that the analysis of the reduction brings in some nice tools. But otherwise, it's just like analyzing classic reduction. Okay, so the one thing, so this one, let's see why this is true. Okay, let's prove this lemma. Actually, this lemma, yeah. Okay. Okay. So what do we need to prove? So V is good. So it has gotten some label L of V. Can people see this color? Okay. So we need to prove that L of V is in the projection set. Okay. To show. Okay, what was L of V? Because V is good, and the way we defined L of V, there is some alpha. The size of alpha is not too big. Log 2 over gamma. Such that GV of alpha was sizable. Okay. Now we have to relate GV of the Fourier coefficients of G to the Fourier coefficients of F on the other side. But now we'll just go back to what the definition was. So recalling what was GV of X, it was defined as the expectation over neighbors of FW of the pullback. Now because of this, again a little exercise, but it's just definition. And it's a good one to do just to make sure you got all the Fourier things and so on. You just take this is my function. And because of this, it's easy to show that the alpha Fourier coefficient of GV is simply the expectation of certain Fourier coefficients of FW. Because everything is linear here. Okay, so you just have to kind of be careful putting the pi's in the correct place. So this quantity is simply the expectation of the Fourier coefficient of the pullback of alpha. Okay, this follows from definition. I mean, you just write it down, take GV of alpha, take that definition, and it works. Okay. And therefore, if I know that GV of alpha is at least gamma by 2, I know that the absolute value of this is at least gamma by 2. In particular, the expected value of the absolute value has to be at least gamma. Right? So because of all this, expectation over neighbors of this Fourier coefficient is at least gamma over 2. I mean, I just took the absolute value inside, that only helps my bound. Very good. And now this is kind of looking good, because to have some chance of being friendly, I better have, first of all, some beta for which the Fourier coefficient was at least gamma over 4. And now I at least know my average Fourier coefficient is somewhat large. And again, by usual averaging, note that all the Fourier coefficients are at most 1. And their average is at least gamma over 2. So by standard averaging, at least gamma over 4 fraction of W have this quantity at least gamma over 4. Okay, the 2s became 4s because of some sloppy average. Okay. And now we're essentially done. So because of this, we know that the way we defined LW, now these are going to be the friendly guys, naturally, right? Because, so these W's are the friendly guys, and they are gamma over 4 of them. So the only thing I need to prove is that they are indeed friendly, namely, L of V belongs to the projection of the set LW. But because of this, how did I define LW? I took all these Fourier coefficients and took the union of their supports. Therefore, by definition, support of this string is a subset of LW for any such friendly thing. Right, because LW was just the union of all these guys, whenever it was at least gamma of. Okay, that's the argument. And now that's basically it, right? So, and now we know that L of V is in support of alpha. Okay, now you just have to, you know, be careful about this pi inverse and all that. But trust me, just these two facts imply that if you pull back, the inverse image of LV must be in LW. Why is that? Let's just check that. I claim this guy is in the support of this. Why is that? Because what is alpha over pi of some j? That is alpha of pi j. And when I take j to be this, right, alpha of pi of that is just alpha LV, which I know is 1 because of the support. And therefore, and that finishes the proof. Right? So this is the same thing. Okay, again, it might look complicated, but, you know, it's just a natural kind of argument. You're decoding based on Fourier coefficients on both sides, and you're producing a small list. On the one side, you're just picking unique elements. On the other side, you pick lists, and for a decent fraction of vertices, a decent fraction of their neighbors have somebody consistent in the list. And then you just throw a dart and pick a random element in that list. That's going to be good enough. Okay, let's see. Okay, so that's, you know, a sense, that's basically the full proof actually of this Hastad's result. The one thing is that I sort of unnecessarily assumed the unique games conjecture, but I think it's good to do that because a lot of the subsequent results here, it's not crucial to work with unique games. There is a way to do it just with label cover. You know, things get a little more complicated because these projections are not bijections, so the analysis is. This has a very similar flavor but differs in some technical details. But for some later things, it is quite crucial to assume unique games. So at least this way I've showed you the paradigm of how you show things from unique games. Pretty much all the things follow the same paradigm. Oh, where did I use the Hamming weight of small, alpha was small? I used it to say, I used it because I'm only list decoding low weight betas there. And to ensure that there is a low weight beta with large thing, I need it. So you're right, I kind of didn't need it in the alpha side, but I need it in the beta. Basically to ensure that LW was small. I mean, of course, LW was small by my definition, but then with that definition, the fact that it is enough to work with that size required the upper bound. Yeah, good question. We certainly used that it's not empty for sure, but we also used the upper bound. And this is where the noise epsilon really is plays the crucial role. That mu, the epsilon bias mu really tells you that you cannot have Fourier mass on the high coefficients. Okay. In some sense, you know, since it's Fourier speckled, I'll say what the epsilon noise, what are all the polymorphisms of the three variable linear equations? It's anything with an odd number of odd parity. Okay, you already see alpha odd coming here. So those are, in some sense, all the polymorphisms in play. The chi alphas with alpha odd. Right? But in general CSP, exact CSP, any odd thing is okay. But we don't like odd parities with very large support. So the noise kills them. And so we are basically saying the only sort of reasonable polymorphisms are those which are an odd and a parity of an odd number of inputs and not too many of them. And in some sense, those look like projections, right? So maybe they don't project on a single coordinate, they project on, they take 100 coordinates and take the XR, not 100, 101, I suppose, if they want odd. But the point is that it's still a small number, so it's like a projection. That's what these arguments use. Okay. Okay, that's that. So, Yeah, it can be formalized. Yeah, it can be formalized. Yeah, and that's actually, so yeah, given the time I have, maybe I'll mention some of that as well, or I can do it offline after the lecture. So, okay. Any other questions? So maybe I'll talk a little bit about max cut next, but before that I want to talk about dictatorship or projection testing. So somehow, one of the reasons I showed the reduction in this way is it basically says that if you assume the unique games conjecture, then all you really need to prove hardness results are what are called dictatorship tests. And what is a dictatorship test? Okay, and this is basically can be formalized into a theorem, and the proof essentially goes like the way we did it, but let's not. So I'll just state what a dictatorship test should be, or a projection test. So in this crowd it will be called a projection function. So we use projections for the label cover projection, so it's all confusing, but what's a dictatorship test? So what you really want to do is that you're given some table G, I'll stick to the Boolean domain, though everything really generalizes to arbitrary domain CFC. Okay, but you're given some table, okay, and I go back to 0, 1 now, so no 1 minus 1. And I want to check if this is like a projection function. Okay, there are R projection functions, and I want to check if it's a projection function. And in some sense, this is what all the gadgets which you do for exact CSP, NP hardness do. Okay, they kind somehow say that you kind of must be a projection. Okay, that's all this PP constructability, PP definability we saw. But now here what we want to do is, suppose you want to show a hardness for, say, max cut. Really, with this unique games recipe, it all boils down to giving a dictatorship test with the following property. Well, first of all, the tests you make, so you'll be given this as a big table, right? For each string x, you'll be given the value g of x. And what you should do is you should randomly probe this test in, say, a few places and make some check. Now, that check should correspond to the CSP you're interested in. So for parity, you read 3 bits and took their XOR. So if you want max cut, what you should do is that you should pick an x somewhere and some y somewhere randomly and check that is g of x, make the check that they are unequal. And you should do this from some clever distribution. So what you will really, the structure of a dictatorship test for the max cut case will simply be this. Pick some some distribution of pairs, pick an xy from a distribution of pairs and check that it's unequal. Okay, this is what you need to check. Actually, there's a very geometric way to think about this in the case of max cut, which is that you have the r dimensional hypercube, 0, 1 to the r. And what is a Boolean function? A Boolean function is simply a cut. It says these vertices go on this side, these vertices go on the other side. So it's some cut like this. And what's your test? Well, you're picking pairs, so that's basically like a graph. So what you're really doing is giving some weighted graph. So these are the hypercube things, but you're actually going to create some clever edges according to your distribution. That's your test. Your test is nothing but a distribution of pairs or a weighted graph on 0, 1 to the r. And your test is simply pick 2 points and check they are on opposite sides of the curve. Okay, so whichever way you want to think about it. Okay, all that is good, but what's the property you need for the test to satisfy? There are 2 properties. One is the completeness. The completeness simply means that if g of x is equal to x sub I, namely a projection function, then test accepts with probability some c. Okay, that's the cut value when you give a dictator function. Yeah? Alpha and beta. You want alpha, beta? Okay, I thought c is for cut, but so this should be beta, right? Yeah. Yeah, thanks. My note says all C and F. I couldn't resist, but let's stick with beta. Okay, so this is what you will get in the good case, when G is like a nice thing. In the other case, you want to say that if G is far from a dictator, probability that the test accepts is at most alpha. Okay, let's throw in a little alpha plus gamma or something. So, okay, so, and this beta will be the completeness and alpha will be the soundness. Okay, and now the question is, okay, this is a loose statement. What does far from a dictator mean? Okay, and we already saw a glimpse of this in the three-lin case. So you had parity functions on a small number of things. That was okay. But if you took the parity of all the bits, that's certainly not like a dictator because it depends on a lot of things. So one way you could imagine saying that it is far from a dictator, or it is, let's say, the opposite. When are you close to a dictator? Maybe if you only depend on few bits. Okay, those functions are called juntas. So we use sort of nice names, dictators and junta. And junta is a function which just maybe picks 25 coordinates and depends on it, but it doesn't care about the rest of the things. So in some sense, it's like a projection, right? It's highlighting a small number of coordinates. So that's kind of what you would like to say, though in reality, you don't say something quite as strong. You use some notion called the influence, okay? So let me define that because it's a nice influential notion. Okay, so what does far from a dictator mean? Far from a dictator means that no single variable has a lot of influence. See, if you took a projection function, so xi, I is stating all the terms. You flip xi, the function changes its value. So in general, it's a natural measure to define what's the influence of a coordinate I on a Boolean function g. Again, all this can be defined for general domains, but let's stick with Boolean. It is simply the probability that g of x changes value when you flip the ith bit of x. And this is over a random x. Okay. So they can again think about this geometrically. You have this hypercube. And you have some crazy function g, right? Okay, one function is a nice function is a projection function. How do projection functions look? They just are slabs. Above this you are 1, below this you are 0. Right? So those guys always have an influence. Take any point, you flip the ith coordinate, the influence of the ith coordinate is 1, the rest of the guys have 0 influence. Okay, that's the dictator. But in general you might have a function, and what you're really saying is, take, if you want the influence of the ith thing, and let's say I is the top direction going this way, you simply take all edges which go up and see what fraction of them cross the cut. That's your influence. That's how influential you are. Okay, that's a very natural definition. And here is an exercise, and it's again a good one to check all the Fourier things, is that you can actually express this influence exactly in terms of the Fourier spectrum. Suppose I have a Boolean function. Now the influence of this, well, okay, so for this maybe it's nicer to make it 1 minus 1, like I said earlier, but that only changes things to a constant factor. So it's not so important. It's simply going to be a sum of all the Fourier coefficients squared, but not all of them, only those guys for which the support of alpha contains I. Okay, this is a fact you can prove. So the influence of the ith coordinate is sum of squares of Fourier coefficients where I belongs to that support. Right, and just as an example, suppose g of x is the projection function x1. Then what's its Fourier expansion? Well, it's just this linear function. So basically, its Fourier coefficient g hat the 1, 0, 0, 0, will be 1, of this string will be 1, and the rest of the guys will be 0. And by this formula, you see that if you sum up squares of all the Fourier coefficients which contain 1, this guy will contribute. Okay, in general, this is the connection between the Fourier analysis and this influence notions and so on. But again, going back, what does far from a dictator mean? Far from a dictator means that for all I in 1 through R, none of the variables has too much influence. some small influence, but tau is some function of the other Greek letters here. So, okay. Okay, but the key point is these things can all be kept independent of R. Yeah, that was your question? Okay. Okay, and that's going to be the more, and this is actually a more general notion than what you get in Hastad's proof, but this captures that also. But this is a more permissive notion of functions which are permissive for far or close. I'll have to think about it. But this is a more general paradigm to use influences instead of the way we decoded them. Okay. So I have, okay, 15, 20 minutes. So maybe what I'll do is talk a little bit about MaxCut. Since we spent so much time on the algorithmic side, I think we should devote some time to MaxCut. Okay, so now let's try to, and now the rule of thumb, which is a theorem really, is that suppose you want to prove hardness for some Boolean CSP or other CSPs, you only have to give a dictatorship test, and then you can crank it through a similar reduction to what I said. You know, have all these tables on both sides, and you know, this basically you can take a dictatorship test and compile it to a reduction from unique games in a systematic way similar to the one I showed. So in virtue of this, at least assuming unique games, your whole problem is down to designing these dictatorship test gadgets. And suppose you want to do it for MaxCut, how will you do it? Okay, and this was done in a paper of Port, Kindler, Mossel, and O'Donnell. Okay, KKMO for us. And how will you do this test? So you're given some function, which now let me call it f, right? And you want to test if it's a dictator or not. As I said, you really need to pick two coordinates and check they are not equal. Right? That's what your test should do. Should pick x, y from some clever distribution. Okay, let's kind of zero in on a natural distribution. What should you do? Well, suppose f of x equals x sub I. Then you would like this test to pass with good probability, right, beta. So what's the natural thing to do? So whatever you do, so it must be the case that xi is not equal to yi with probability beta. We would like this, right? If all the dictators have to pass through with this, it should be at least, this must be true. Let's as well make it exactly equal to beta. Okay, why give it more? Why do more than we have to? Okay, so now this suggests a natural distribution, right? So what you will do is that you will pick x at random. And now the y, what do I need to do? I need to go to each xi and flip it with probability beta. Now y is that yi equals xi with probability 1 minus beta and xi bar with probability beta. Independently for each i. It's a product distribution. That's it. That's my test. So again, in the view of the hypercube, what I'm really, the way I'm sampling edges, these yellow edges, is I go to a random point, and then I flip each coordinate with independently with probability beta, and I put an edge. More or less, this is the same because of concentration, that you basically connect up pairs which differ in about beta coordinates. Okay, so this is some sort of Knesser graph-like object. Connect up pairs which differ at some Hamming distance. Okay, but you do it in this sort of independent sampling way. It's a little bit cleaner always to do the analysis. Okay, so now that part is fine. By design, completeness is fine, and that's always the case. You design the test so that the completeness is easy. Okay, what about the soundness? Okay, that's where the key thing is. Okay. So to analyze the soundness, we'll just again use Fourier analysis. But in this case, I won't be able to give you the full proof, but what I hope to do in the last 10-15 minutes is at least kind of give some indication of where the hardness comes from, and somehow the nice duality with the algorithm which we saw, the Gomans-Williams algorithm. Okay, so that's all we'll have time for. So for the soundness, so the soundness really is really the probability that for two things which you flip, so x at random, and y is basically the noisy version, the beta noisy version of x. Okay, it's some sort of a random variable. This is just a notation for how I sample. And this is actually defined to be what is called the noise sensitivity of f. Because what you're really doing is you're starting at a random point and kind of perturbing its coordinates with some probability. And you're interested in how sensitive the function is to this noise. Okay, so hence the name noise sensitivity of f. Okay, sometimes it's also used for noise stability, which is 1 minus this, but for this lecture we will, I don't know what standard, probably Ryan will know, but we will define this to be noise sensitivity. Sensitivity is good. Okay, then I'll boldly write it. Noise sensitivity. Okay, so really the probability of any function passing this test is exactly its noise sensitivity. Okay, I haven't said much, it's just a definition. But this at least says that it's a sort of a basic notion which has been studied and so on, in lots of contexts, in voting theory and so on. You have some voting rule. How stable is it if kind of you miscount each vote with some probability, you know, 1 in 1,000, what's the probability the election got rigged by this, right? So it's a very natural notion, and it comes up. And okay, another exercise, and again, all my Fourier things are exercises. So n is beta of f. Okay, so this should be beta. Is exactly, it has a Fourier expansion also, and it's not hard, again a good exercise. It's going to look a lot like Hastad's thing, except instead of a cube, you have a square. And believe me, like a lot of things in the world, 3 versus 2 makes a big difference, and this is a much harder thing to analyze. Okay, so this is the noise sensitivity. So note that when, just a sanity check, when beta is 0, this is 1 minus sum of Fourier squares by 2. And of course, when beta is 0, the noise sensitivity is 0. You don't flip anything, you don't change anything. Okay, but in general, this is how it goes. Okay. So as written, it might look like a quantity which is less than half, but it's not. I mean, in fact, in the max cut case, it will be more than half, because note that this can be negative. Okay. So it's just, this is what it is. And the probability that the test accepts is exactly a noise sensitivity. Okay. So now we need to understand, if a function is far from a dictator, is it the case that what is the maximum noise sensitivity you can have if you are far from a dictator? Okay, so one thing I should say is, of course, ns beta of the projection function, I'll now use that nice projection term. If I project on the ith coordinate, what is its noise sensitivity? The dictator's. Beta, right? Because you flip that coordinate or not. Or if you like Fourier things, you can see it from this expression as well. There will be one Fourier coefficient with support 1, which is 1. So you'll get 1 minus 1 minus 2 beta by 2. Okay, but of course, it follows by definition. Again, another sanity check. Okay, let's see. So really we would like to understand what's the most noise sensitive you can be. So in some sense, these guys are very noise sensitive, right? If you flip something with probability 0.9, they're definitely going to flip with probability 0.9. So we are interested in, okay, so these guys are very noise sensitive, but we would like to say that if you have a function which is not quite like a projection, far from a dictator, it is not that noise sensitive. It's kind of a little more stable. Okay. So if you think of a function which is, does not look like a dictator, what's one example you would give? Parity, no. okay, but parity is good, but it has a lot of influential coordinates, right? So because parity is something, in some sense, it doesn't have to pass our test. Majority. Okay, that's the answer I wanted, because that's what I'm prepared for. So no, but it really is some sense a quintessential function. And if you think of a voting rule, right, what's a good voting rule? It's probably majority, right? Not dictators, or not parity for sure, you know. The last person comes and he decides the election. No, that's, maybe it's fine, but you don't want parity. So now the question is really majority is what I'm going to focus on. Okay, and this connects up very beautifully to the algorithmic part, which I hope to convey in the remaining time. So now the real question is, what's the probability that majority flips its answer? Okay, for this way, for the way I sample this thing. When I flip each coordinate with probability beta, what's the chance majority flips the answer? Okay, so I mean, this is a well-studied question in analysis, but I'll like try to give some intuition, hopefully also connecting up to the rounding algorithm. Okay, so I'll make one notational switch. So you knew it was coming. So now I'll make the notational switch in the other point. You can make it 0, 1, or let's make it. So I'll make it 1 minus 1 on both sides. And the reason I want to do this is that majority is particularly nice in this world. So majority of x is simply the sine function on the sum. Right? Otherwise, I have to put a sine of this minus n over 2, that's r over 2, that's just annoying. So it's just a sine function. Okay. So now, therefore, what is this? So this is just the probability over my xy, that's the sine of summation xi is not equal to the sine of summation yi. Change colors. And for some reason, which will be clear shortly, I am going to add a normalizing factor. So instead of sine, I am just going to put in a scalar 1 over square root r. Okay, that doesn't affect the sine. Okay, good. But why am I doing this strange thing? Okay, the point is, what is x? Let's just look at this guy first. X was a uniform plus 1 minus 1 string. Now I change it to 1 minus 1. So really x is uniform in 1 minus 1 to the r. And y is the noisy version of x. Okay, what is this quantity of x? If the x is a random plus 1 minus 1, what does that tend to? It tends to a Gaussian, right? So basically this is just a Gaussian, but so this actually tends to the standard normal variable. Right? But I want to actually write it slightly differently. It also tends, the sum of Gaussians is also Gaussian. So I will write this as summation gi. So somehow, and this is actually the going from the discrete world to the continuous world. So instead of taking sine of summation plus 1 minus 1 bits, I'm now we're going to take sine of sum of independent Gaussian. So gi are iid Gaussian. Okay, that's what this is like. Again, I won't be completely precise here, but you will get the intuition. So this guy is just the sine of this quantity. Okay? And likewise, of course, this guy is the sine of 1 over root r summation mu I gi. Where what is mu I? Mu I was this guy, which was 1 with probability 1 minus beta and minus 1 otherwise. You're flipping with probability beta. Okay, so mu I was minus 1 with probability beta, 1 with probability 1 minus beta. Okay? Okay, very good. So why did I do all this? So now the analysis is simply the following, right? So what am I asking? Let me define two vectors. Let me define A to be this unit vector, 1 over square root r. And the square root r simply comes because, you know, the variance, if you sum up all these guys, should be 1. Okay, then that's when you make the variance 1, that's our normalization. And here it's just this unit vector. So it's all 1's unit vector. That's my A. And I'll define B. So after I sample these mu i's, let me first sample the mu i's, let's say. So now these guys are fixed, so it's going to be mu 1 by root r, mu r by root r. Both are unit vectors, because the mu I is also a plus 1 minus 1 valued variable. So both are unit vectors. And what am I asking here? By the probability that the sine of summation xi was not equal to the sine of summation yi is essentially equal to modulo all these approximations in the central limit theorem. So I should have said that this is by the central limit theorem. Right? Okay, there are very precise quantitative versions of this, so you know the error terms and so on. So I hide all that here. So this is simply the probability that you replace these by Gaussians. But then what you get is exactly the sign of A dot the Gaussian differs from the sign of B dot the Gaussian. And this G vector is really a vector where all the components G1 through GR are IID Gaussian. Now this should look very familiar, right? And this is exactly the quantity which we analyzed in the Gomez-Williams phenomenon. So we know what it is. It's really the angle between A and B divided by pi. Okay, you took a random hyperplane cut. What's the chance A and B fell on the different side? So your hyperplane must pass between A and B, which is R cosine A dot B by pi. And what is A dot B? Well, it's approximately equal to each of, it's basically just the summation of mu i's, right? By R, the average value of the mu i. Each mu i is 1 with probability 1 minus beta minus 1 otherwise. So it's like 1 minus 2 beta on the average. Okay, so that's like 1 minus 2 beta. Cos inverse. Okay, that's it. So, of course, I haven't shown the full thing. I've just analyzed the case of majority. But I don't have time for it, but it's stated in this handwritten notes I've also posted that there is a theorem by KKMO, which, not by KKMO, there was by Mosel, O'Donnell, Oleshkovich, which is a companion paper, which showed that really the function which is sort of most sensitive among guys which are not like dictators is the majority. So this is in some sense the extremal case. And that proof also uses ideas like this, the continuous and going passing to the Gaussian. And therefore this is really it. This is the soundness of the test. So what we therefore have, just to conclude, is dictators pass the test with probability beta. Far from dictators pass the test with exactly cos inverse 1 minus 2 beta by pi. Okay, you have to always throw in some error terms. And this recipe which we saw in the case of 3-lin, you can really take this and get a unique game hardness result, which says that if a graph has a cutoff size beta, it is hard to find, if I define this to be alpha, it's hard to find an alpha beta approximation. And if you recall, this is exactly what the Gomez-Williamson algorithm achieved. Okay, and that shows that this 0.878 factor, I think when beta equals 0.875 something, okay, that I don't know, but something like that, 845 I think. So if you take beta as 0.845, you get the ratio between these two to be 0.878. Okay, and you get that type. But in any, for any beta, this shows that this comma beta approximating it is hard. In some cases, you can actually, as Ryan showed the curve, in some cases for beta below this, you can actually do a little bit better. But certainly doing this is, you can actually show a stronger hardness result, but certainly this is already hard. And it sort of matches the curve exactly at every point. For any beta, we exactly know the function of beta which you can approximate. But certainly for large beta, this is the correct function. Okay, I think I should probably stop there. Was there anything? And there I'll just conclude by mentioning is that this is just one case of such a result. What followed from this is that if you look at the way this test was constructed, it has clearly, you know, you sort of feel it, right? It has strong connections to the integrality gap, the Feige-Shekman graph, which Ryan showed, and indeed the rounding algorithm of Gomez-Williamson. So this nice duality between algorithms and hardness. And this was sort of widely suspected and, you know, beautifully confirmed by later result of Prasad Raghavendra, who showed this for any CSP, that you can take a gap instance for a certain SDP and essentially execute the same kind of thing. Give a matching dictatorship test. Okay. And so I think I'll stop there.